Warning, this podcast discusses addiction, mental health, and other sensitive topics. Please listen with care and take a break if needed. You are not alone, and support is available.
Hey everybody, this is Andrew and Jay, and this is Malfunction Junction, and this will be our first episode. My co-host here, Jay, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hell yeah, welcome everybody.
Yeah, and so yeah, this will be our, like I said, first episode. We're going to do this weekly. Malfunction Junction is a podcast about addiction and mental health issues, other stuff like that. We started the podcast because there's kind of I saw a lack of this in the podcast space, a lack of talk about addiction and about mental health stuff that was, I don't know, viable and interesting, so I figured I might as well try to add to that and see what we can do. And I asked Jay here to help because he is an excellent conversationalist and is also well-versed in most of those topics as well. Yeah. So I think we'll be able to make a good podcast for y'all. Today we're basically just going to go over kind of our own personal stories with addiction. We will cover basically just the, you know, early stories of what it was like before addiction, deep struggle, what was a turning point, early recovery stuff, and then some tips and tricks for if you are finding yourself in recovery. But yeah, so we'll go ahead and get started. Jay, I'll ask you a question first. What was your life like before addiction?
It's hard to pinpoint exactly when I would describe as being prior to addiction. Definitely before the more dangerous aspects of addiction later in my life with things like alcohol. But I mean, even growing up, I mean, I struggled with caffeine. I started porn addiction at a very early age. So to go back pre-addiction, I mean, it would be, you know, 8 to 10 years old, you know. Those points were just more carefree, but I think that kind of largely covers most people's childhoods. It just didn't have the same pressures, a need to find the same coping mechanisms on repeat. There wasn't as much self-soothing then, and it was also prior to my parents' divorce, so there was obviously more home stability and whatnot. Following that, from that point on, that's the self-soothing and coping mechanisms stuck with from 10 till now at 25 years old.
Yeah, and it's kind of a lifelong thing, as we find out. We don't really think of it that way as when we're kids. I mean, I remember, I'm sure you were, I don't know if you guys did this in Florida, but in California we had the DARE program. I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm sure you guys had that.
Of course.
Yeah, and that was like, that was in the time for me, like where it was kind of before addiction. But, and when we were in that time period of like going through the DARE classes, and that would be in the schools in like, I think it was sixth grade.
Big seminars and stuff.
Just did it in classes, and we just had it in the actual classroom. But I remember it was like kind of what taught us how to get high, and like it's just like not a good thing. That's probably not what that was supposed to be for. But I remember I made like the highlighter pipe. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It was pretty good, too.
I won't lie to you. At the time, it scared the shit out of me. I was terrified of the DARE program. And after that, my mom had been very big on it. I did not have any interest in following the path of drugs a couple years later, in which case I was like, hey, remember what they said about Sharpies and, and whipped cream cans? Yeah.
And fucking huffing. Uh-huh. Huffing was the dumbest shit. I remember one of my buddies who shall remain nameless due to the fact that we don't have a very good relationship right now.
Fair play.
He got into some big trouble because of huffing. Mm-hmm. His mom like found him like passed out with like a thing of duster and he almost died. You know, that's not good.
No.
he was 12, 13 years old. Uh-huh.
Looked at the friends I had that were doing that shit as like absolute degenerates. I was like, these kids are clearly fucked up. And then I got a little older and I started to understand a little more. Luckily, I stayed out of the duster and huff and stuff, but I mean, it was never too far out of arm's reach.
No, the worst I ever did with that type of thing was I figured out you could get high off of inhalers. And I would
is
just
is that
like,
true? Can we test the theory?
It's supposed to be an addiction podcast.
That's right. We're in recovery.
Yeah, it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Which we'll eventually get into that topic as well of the aspect of recovery. It's a very broad topic given there's a lot of different ways that it can be accomplished. Mm-hmm. We at Malfunction Junction believe that it's whatever is good enough for you. Just don't do anything that's going to kill you.
Yeah, about harm reduction. I mean, we talk about breaking the cycles of addiction. We're both here vaping.
Sure.
And in that, we found something that's significantly less harmful to our lives, I think, than much of the stuff that, at least for me, that I was doing before and the problems that I was having.
I still smoke a cigar a day.
Yeah,
but,
Like, that's classy.
That's not.
You're not going to end up in a ditch from that, some minor health risks in 30 years, but,
I used to smoke 2 packs of cigarettes a day, so it's better than that.
Right, and I think that's a big thing in general when it comes to coping mechanisms, is the idea is largely flawed that we can just eradicate them entirely. You have to have coping mechanisms. So finding ones that work, and obviously the circles that we've met in are a big part of that, finding things that replicate the things of addiction before that did give us some stability in life without having the things that take away from our ability to function as individuals, express ourselves, and actually work through the shit that we had go on when we were younger or throughout our lives.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That should be the focus point of any coping mechanism, in my opinion, is that you can handle it.
Yeah, and as we get on more on this podcast, we'll explain both of our own trauma points that lead us to where we are today. How old were you when you first encountered drugs and alcohol? Drugs first and then alcohol, for me.
No, I think I was the other way around. I mean, the first time I ever drank anything, I was probably 12 or 13. It was by accident. The first time I started drinking was around 14 to 15. It wasn't until I got to high school. And then I smoked a little after that. I didn't touch weed too much throughout high school. I cleaned up my act for a good year and a half. I was in a steady relationship. I was wrestling a lot. Mm-hmm. And it was really for me when drugs took a turning point as being a significant handicap to my life was college. It was as soon as I got out of my hometown. Mm-hmm. And that's when things became really problematic. Prior to that, most of my addiction cycles were, again, more along the lines of bad coping mechanisms, bad habits.
Right,
looking to the wrong outlets consistently. And just, again, showing the early warning signs of addictive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And then once we got distance and there was a little bit of free reign, it started kicking the shoes off a little bit.
For me, it was, if I had to send it all the way back to like a gateway drug or gateway moment, it was literally the first time I ever tried tobacco. Mm. Dipping tobacco. I had a can of Copenhagen that my homie Tanner, shout out Tanner, got us a can of Copenhagen straight. I think it was either straight or long cut, but it was whatever it was. I put that shit in my lip for the first time. It was just like,
and that hooked you?
Literally immediately.
I feel like that.
Literally immediately. It was the first time I ever realized that you could change your consciousness. I was like 13.
Mm.
So I was like, I think I was 13.
You would
have thrown up. So I didn't throw up. Loved it immediately. I dipped it. Dipped for the next 5 years until I stopped dipping when I went to Europe because they don't sell dip there. I switched to cigarettes.
Got it.
But, so dip kind of as much as it sounds, they always blame weed for gateway drugs. They blame alcohol for gateway drugs, but you don't really get nicotine blamed so much, but that's what it was for me. And, I remember that was like 13, and then the next, like, I think it was high school was soon after that, and then I started smoking weed in high school, like freshman year, and I remember I didn't really like it that much, and but then I got like crossed for the first time. I went to a party with a buddy of mine who was a couple years older than me, and he took me to a couple years older party, and I remember I got like just obliterated, and like I didn't throw up, but I was pretty fucked up.
And,
and
you liked
at the time, I loved it. But then I had to go to church the next day.
You have a very backwards experience with drugs. Where it's like, most people, I feel like, dip and stuff like that. Like, that's how you get somebody to stop doing tobacco. Is like a dad makes his kid do for 10 times in a row. Or, like, with weed, the first time I was like, this isn't for me, was when I got crossfaded. And I was like, what the fuck happened to me last night?
No.
So that was when you were just starting.
Well,
that was the turn up. All right.
It was, like, kind of... I guess it wasn't because the next day after that first experience of getting crossed was like one of the worst days of my life.
Yeah,
I remember I got angry at all my friends. It was very early. That was before like I had been diagnosed with any mental health or anything like that, and so it was like what is happening to me?
Right, and those early hangovers are the worst because you can't talk to your parents or adults.
No.
You just have to suffer.
You just have to pretend.
I just got a headache, Mom. You can't really be asking for too much Advil.
Unfortunately, no.
You don't want to let him in on the symptoms. It's brutal. You just got to suffer through it.
It's the worst, and yeah, eventually it was what got me on to weed like significantly. Was I kind of had stopped smoking for a while, and then I read in an article one day. I was super depressed. I was like ridiculously depressed at age 15 or whatever. Mm-hmm. I had had surgery on my shoulder. We share the fact that we were wrestlers, and I had a surgery on my shoulder, and it just ruined my career for wrestling. And it was recently relatively promising, at least. Wouldn't have been nothing crazy, but you know, I had a promising career, and it was just completely taken away at age 15, 16 because of a surgery. And I was just depressed. I didn't have my friends around me because they were all in sports and I was all away, and it just sucked all the time. And I remember reading in an article on ESPN of all places about cannabis being a cure for depression. It was an article about the Oregon Ducks players and how there were kids in at the University of Oregon like trying to get the weed stuff like passed by because it was helping them with depression.
It was Oregon. Yeah.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
And this was that also during the time where Oregon was like super good at football. Mm-hmm. They're pretty still good, but like they were. This was like the DeAnthony Thomas and like this like their 2011 team where they had just like everybody.
That big dude that was jacked as all hell.
Which one?
Sean something.
No, that was on Baylor.
That big motherfucker.
Yeah. I remember I read that article and then I sought out a friend who I like knew had weed, and I remember we smoked. Shout out Sam, and we smoked, and I remember that like pretty vividly. We went and got burritos and like just being super high for like the first time in a long time, and just being like, this is the best, eating a burrito, just like, oh yeah. And then I got home and my mom goes, you smell like weed. I was like, fuck. And I just like came clean to her. I was like, yeah, I started smoking because I'm super depressed, and I feel like I read somewhere that it helped, and I decided to start smoking. And she was like, well, did it work? And I remember lying to her. I was like, no, it didn't. But I was thinking to myself, like, that was the best day I've had in fucking like forever, dude. So I didn't. That was actually on 419, bicycle day. Then I remember that because the next day was 420, of course. And I woke up and there were 100 pelicans on my backyard pond that I grew up, like in the nature reserve that I grew up on. 100 pelicans. That had never happened before.
Can you make sense of this to me? Why were there 100 pelicans?
That's a good question.
They
were just there, and there were no more fish in our pond after that.
Is there any tie to bicycle day?
I just woke up, and I was like, God damn.
Bicycle day, you woke up on 420, and there's pelicans in the backyard.
I smoked. The day I got caught smoking was on bicycle day, and then woke up the next day, it was 420, and there were 100 pelicans on my pond, and I was like, it's a sign.
It's a hell of a first experience.
It was great.
I remember the first time I smoked in college was similar to that, except that obviously I was away from my mom would never have been okay with that. When she did eventually find out,
mom was not okay with it.
Oh, shit, you still got in trouble.
Well, I got in a lot of trouble for that.
I
was able to convince her with the whole like depression thing that I was I'm not like trying to be a druggie. I just wanted to try something. I'm not going to do it again. And then I didn't for a while.
Got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I the first time I got caught, kind of, was doing a dab. And I had a bunch of friends that lied to me, convinced me, oh, yeah, dude, you'll be fine in 2 hours. You'll go home fine.
2 hours? And try like six, man.
Yeah, I couldn't.
Dab for the first time?
My eyes red as hell. I couldn't do eye drops. I was terrified.
Yeah.
My mom saw me and was like, why are your eyes red? And then I made a, sorry to my boy Dylan. I lied and said his grandfather died. We're talking about losing father. It wasn't long, you know, it was a few years after my father passed. Yeah, and so I was like, you know, we were talking about the loss of father figures, and his dad or his granddad committed suicide. And so I started crying. My mom was like, it's okay.
It's terrible, but it's so funny.
It is. It worked. If his grandfather was dead, shout out. I'll dap you up when I get to the other side.
Right, yeah.
But, that was still, like, smoking when I was going back home was the worst fucking experience of my life. Every time, it was just paranoia to the end. And then I went to college and got that space, and then I got to have an experience like you did where we just loaded up on Hot Pockets, sat in the room, and then from that first time, I had a good experience with it, as opposed to, like, high school. I did, you know, 3 or 4 times. With my cousin and with that, you know, friend and his group of friends. Once I went to college and I smoked, I didn't stop smoking I was high for 3-4 months.
Yeah.
Then switched to drinking and then went back and smoked every day for like 2.5 years. I had a good experience, I was like, all right, this is what I'm doing now.
Yeah. I mean, and then I personally don't care about weed. Weed's a benign thing in my mind. It can be a thing where you can definitely get to yourself with a point with weed where you're gone. And some people cannot smoke weed. Some people have the predisposition for schizophrenia or whatever you want to call it and can't smoke weed because it just sucks. But some people are able to do that, and everybody should be able to do it to each their own.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I remember the weed when I was that young, it was a problem for me because it was when I was, you know, in high school, and it was just like I was, you know, it was the true stereotype of like the lazy stoner and just kind of wanting to say fuck off. And because I had had some issues with like authority figures in early, probably middle school in like 7th and 8th grade, I'd had a teacher essentially kind of violate my trust. By taking my cell phone and reading all my text messages. It was enough to like piss me off against authority figures. Yeah. And I lost my complete respect for it. And so in high school, I just like with the amount that weed already makes you do that, the amount that weed already makes you go, fuck this shit, man.
Right.
Like it was, I already had that inside of me. And then the weed just like made it like 10 times that.
Amplified.
So I was just like, I was constantly in high school. I should not have graduated, but like I did. And the only reason I wasn't able to go to college was because I wrote my senior thesis on weed, and because my English professor at the time was like, yeah, no, and he gave me an F, and I got a D in the class, and I had like a small scholarship to go to Boise State, and like, nope.
You'd think California's the one place you'd get away with it too.
Oh, for real, right? Right? For real. Especially where I grew up, too. I grew up in Placer County,
happen in, like, Florida of California, I would think it would be like, nice, man. Good study, dude.
It was a good paper, too. Especially because I'm a good writer. Like, I knew it was a good paper, and that was what pissed me off so much about it. Because if it was a shit paper, I get it. But it was a good paper. Just give me what I fucking deserved. Anyway. So, yeah, that was that. During that time, it definitely, like, took me for a ride. I didn't really start drinking a lot, which I would... If I had to pick a DOC drug of choice, which I usually, when I ask that question, I say, whatever you got. Mm-hmm. But it was mainly alcohol as the one I see it as the one that ruined my life the most. The one that had the most potential to do the most damage to my life, because it did do a lot of damage to my life. But I didn't start drinking until college I had drinking with regularity in college. And as soon as I figured out that I could pay someone that was older than me to go buy alcohol, it was like, okay, I'm going to do this a lot. And then I figured out that I could just go in and buy it, and because I looked a lot older than I am.
Yep.
And like, so I could just go in and buy it. And then after that, it was gone. It was just off to the races. I was drinking every day.
Yeah. And I hate to stereotype. All you got to do is find like the one Arab guy who owns his own liquor store.
Oh my God, I know, for real, dude. You just have to, that, it was that guy.
I mean, I bought Black and Milds when I was like 13 from a gas station that was how we eventually... And then I got to college, found a guy like that for alcohol, and then I never didn't have liquor in my apartment. It was constantly there.
Yeah, always. And it was my thing was, I would drink liquor, but I would drink beer to start because I like the taste of beer. And I drink beer to start. And what is it? It's beer before liquor, never sicker. So that was just me constantly. Just like, when I would drink the liquor. Yeah, at a certain point, I stopped drinking the liquor afterwards and would just drink like 20 beers. But, you know, whatever.
It wasn't beer before liquor. I was Everclear before liquor.
God damn.
I was starting off with a good old bottle of grain alcohol.
God damn.
Yeah, getting into it.
That's crazy. Yeah. But then when college was kind of also at the time when things got out of control, I started doing harder drugs. At first, just like psychedelics, but then I got to cocaine. And then eventually got all into methamphetamine. At that time in life, it eventually got worse than that.
Right.
But, at the time I was about, I think I was 20 the first time I did speed like that. And I remember I did like methylphenidate, which is Ritalin. I just crushed it up and just railed it. And then wrote a 36 page paper for a class and got an A. I was like, oh shit, this is awesome. I kept doing it, kept doing it. Eventually I ran out. It was like, and then someone was like, dude, you know you can do speed, like real speed, like meth. I was like, oh, okay, that's the same thing? Well, methamphetamine, it's not the same thing.
No.
But it just got me to be like, okay, fuck it, like, why not? And it just, like, opened it up, and then thankfully I enjoyed methylphenidate more than I enjoyed methamphetamine, because it lasts shorter. But, I was doing that for a while, and specifically in my time period when I was 20 to 22 living in San Francisco and
do you feel like that kind of swing into harder drugs, more consistent drug use, especially anything dissociative like alcohol, do you feel that at that time it was more due to the fact that you were getting older and becoming more aware of the pressures, responsibilities, all the unhealed shit, and that was kind of catching up to you? Or was it like the positive reward cycles of, all right, well, this is getting me by, and so you convince yourself it's a good thing? Or was it trying to get away from the bad?
I think it was trying to get away from the bad. Yeah, that definitely makes sense. And I think it was trying to get away because I had...
It's always a big mix of both, of course.
You know, and everyone's got trauma. No one's had something that's worse. I mean, there are things that are worse than others, but it's not a competition. It's definitely... This is, if you're making a competition over trauma, you are fucked, dude. But, you know, I've had a pretty significant amount of trauma in my life. And so it was all about covering up what I was dealing with. Yeah. And, and then also like trying to find out like what's going on in my mind. 'Cause that was what psychedelics was in my mind was for. I was trying to figure out like what is going on in my brain. Because I've been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and so it's like, I was always wondering, like, why the fuck am I just, like, going crazy a lot?
Yeah.
And so psychedelics...
What age were you diagnosed?
16. Yeah. You can be officially diagnosed at 18 in California, at least at the time. I don't know what it is now, but legally, I think it's 18 to be diagnosed, but I was, like, unofficially diagnosed at 16.
Got it.
It was apparent pretty early on that I was dealing with something pretty severe. And, it was, you know, tough, but it was also, eye-opening with the psychedelics, because it made me kind of realize that, like, I had this other side of my brain that was, you know, kind of impressive. Mm-hmm. But it was impressive in a way that it was scary. And so, like, digging into your brain when you're, you know, not quite sure, and you're kind of not sure what you're going to find, and you're kind of scared of what you're going to find. It's definitely, I get why people don't want to do psychedelics.
Of course.
I get why it,
people, and truly, but I was just never people, afraid of it. It. Handling that is a step in the wrong direction at times. Where I've seen people who, you know, went on these deeper psychedelic trips, you know, didn't have that capacity yet to handle those things. And then it drives you further into this mental state of kind of, you know, like you said, it's battling this demon, not really being sure of what it is, not being fully understanding or aware of what its power is. And then you start facing that and it's like, holy fuck. I mean, the first really bad experience I had was like that, where I started digging in and kind of compartmentalizing these different parts of my brain. And it just sent me down this kind of loop. And therapy was very similar to that. I mean, it was, both of them were digging into these parts that I was like, yeah, let's leave the cobwebs on that, man. I'm all right there.
Oh, yeah.
And then as a result of that, over time, it just, you know, forced me to unravel. And so at some point you need that. You got to have that restart, re-break the bone if you're going to heal it again. But at the wrong time, when you got to limp a little bit, it's just not worth it.
Yeah, know? And that time in life, the 18 to, I'd say about 23, 24, I had a little bit different of a time period at 23, which I'll get to in a sec. But it's a really, like, it's a formative time in life, and it's also a very, like, dangerous time in life. It's that's when the age that I lost most of the friends that I, like, during the time period that I lost most friends that I have, it was around between that age period, age group. And then a little bit plus that too, probably up to about 27 with that one. And I mean, there's a reason why, like, there's the 27 club in Rockstar stuff. 'Cause it's like, it's a statistical thing of people that die early. It's that are in rock and roll. It's 27. That's the average age. And there's a reason why. It's 'cause that's when you burn out.
It's a big transitional period. It's where a lot of your friends that are not on that path start to switch into families and settling down. For me, it was a big reason, like you talked about, of losing all those friends, of why I got into hard drinking in the first place in college. Because all of a sudden, I feel alone. I'm separate from all the things that I had that tethered me to some sort of, like, normalcy growing up. And then, you know, you have that other transitional period a couple years later. Your friends leave college. All right, well, where are you going? Are you going off? Are you getting a new job?
Right.
Then 25 to 27, you got friends. They're getting married. They're settling down. They're talking about having kids. And depending on where you are, you either fall into it or fall out of it. Or if you're the person that, you know, happens to be in that early, sometimes it pushes you away from all the people that aren't doing that. And then you have the inverse, where sometimes all your friends are doing that and you're the one who's not.
Right.
And so you just start drawing those lines in the sand and kind of, you know, isolating yourself inadvertently, just because that's how the, you know, swing of life goes.
Yeah. And for me, the reason that there was isolation was probably because I was the one that was doing the crazy drugs. And so people were avoiding me. And I get it. And, like, I would have avoided me too. I was going insane. And it's, you know, I eventually kind of got to a point where, with psychedelics, where I kind of felt like I'd broken my brain. And there was this one particular experience when I was living in San Francisco, where I had taken a significant dose of LSD with my buddy Isaac. Shout out Isaac. We're still buds. Oh, I know he's going to listen to this. So
this podcast is just
too many shout outs. Too many shout outs. I don't give a fuck. This is
the story of how I started unraveling.
Shout out
my boy.
Shout out Isaac.
Yeah.
Anyway, we took a significant dose of LSD, and I remember laying there smoking a cigarette inside my house on my back, just laying up, like, blowing the smoke up to the ceiling. And I could see smoke rising from my mouth, but then all that would come up it would always go into a yin yang symbol. And it was just like, what the fuck is going on? And then I had, like, a crazy vision where I envisioned myself as a homeless man dying in San Francisco. And I was just like, it scared me straight. And then, like, the next day was actually St. Patrick's Day, coming up in a few days now. That was on 3/16, so a couple days from now, probably be on the day that this drops, actually. Nice.
Shout out the Irish.
Shout out the Irish.
Shout out to Potato Famine.
It is. That was 3/16, 2018. And we took a bunch of LSD, and it was a very scary experience. And then the next day, St. Patrick's Day, drank a bunch, came back to San Francisco from, I was in Concord, and we came back to San Francisco, and I remember I met a friend at a bar and just like broke down and was just like, dude, I am a fucking mess. I am don't know what I'm doing with my life. I feel like I'm gonna die. Like I'm like, and like went home that night, got back to San Francisco, and then got like super angry at my roommate, and like for no reason. It was my fault completely. And like then he like ended up the next day calling our landlord in on it and was like, they literally, I was on my computer searching rehabs. I was on rehab.com or rehabs. Whatever it is, rehabs.com. And I was searching for rehab anywhere. And they, I remember I got a knock on my door for them like about to evict me because I was like kind of threatening to my roommate. And he was, I just, first thing I said, I know I fucked up. I'm sorry. I'm signing up for rehab right now. I have a drug addiction problem. And I'll never forget the look on their face. It was just literally like, there was the look of like such diffusion. It was just like, they both went into it like about to yell at me, and then they both went into it like needing to give me a hug.
Yeah,
I get it. He's really suffering. We'll give him some grace here.
And it's a common theme in any sort of addiction or negative coping mechanism, you know, style behavior patterns, where I think if you're willing to take the first step, at the bare minimum acknowledgement, the amount of support that will outpour for you from people that you never thought would be supportive is insane.
Right.
And I think so many times when I was deeper in those cycles, I assumed that nobody gave a shit because I was constantly lying about how well I was doing. Like, always. I'm like, I'm fine. And then I'm like, see, nobody fucking asks. Nobody cares. Nobody digs deeper.
Right.
And it's like, I'm giving this false illusion.
Right.
And the second I was like, dude, I'm falling apart, man. Or like, I started talking about depression more openly around my friend circles. And the amount of people I had that started texting me, reaching out, asking how I was, etc. shocked me. It absolutely floored me. I was not prepared for that. It's such a powerful thing to acknowledge it before other people try and force it on you.
Yeah, and it helps with your, if you're in a tough spot. And I mean that's what I mean in AA, which I've had a tough time with AA in the past. It helps. We'll do whatever you got to do. But AA, I mean, even their first step is acknowledgement that you have no power over this essentially, right. That is the first step. Acknowledgement that you have no power. And so that's what I did, and I checked myself into a rehab. I wanted to get away from California, went out to Texas, Austin, Texas, Recovery Unplugged in Austin, Texas, and there's a couple of those places. They're great. They're a great organization. At least they were when I was there. I don't know what they're like now. But I went out there and I checked myself in, and I stayed there for 4 months. In Texas, and then that was the first time in my life I got sober, and it was the first time in my life that I'd actually felt like happy, right. Like for more than like a couple minutes. Like I had like an actual, like I had a good life back there for a little while. Like it was before all the people started moving to Texas, to Austin. So it was kind of like the last, someone told me it was like the last year that it felt like Austin to them.
Right.
And I was like, okay. But I don't know. I was only there for 4 years, but in the end, at least. But 4 months for this time. And during that 4 months, I was sober the whole time, and it was great. And then I had to go back to California because my parents were going to sell the house, and I had to get all my shit. Immediately slipped back into to drinking first, and then it got back to all the way back to cocaine. And for a little while, crack. That was where I started smoking crack. And it just like it began to spiral. I eventually went back to Texas because I had bought a truck, but I had no money to get to Texas. I convinced my dad to give me enough gas money to get there by the idea that I would just go to rehab. You know, he gave me enough gas money just based on that, and I was like, and then I got there and was immediately like, I don't want to go to fucking rehab.
Right, of course
I not. Did eventually go to rehab, but there was like a 3-day period where I just holed up in a fucking motel and smoked crack. And just like, yeah. And
that was your Alamo.
That was my Alamo. Yeah, I believe it was the La Quinta under the bridge in Austin. There's a bunch of bridges there, but like a bunch of overpasses. But there's this one was I'll always remember this one. Mm-hmm. And but then I eventually ended up going back to rehab, and that was I got sober again. I was sober for a couple like a month, and then got into some trouble. One night when I started drinking with a buddy of mine, we were just drinking. We went and like did some tagging and shit over like on like an abandoned building and
that spray painting.
Yeah, yeah. And then we went. We came back to the place where we were staying, and this kid like offered to sell us some acid, and I think he was offering to sell us some cocaine too. And so we got the acid, and then we were like. We were hitting him up. We got his number because we were like, we might want to get some cocaine too. And then we did the acid, and I was like, this is not fucking acid, because it was N-bomb, and I was
what
like,
is that?
It's 25I. It's a different chemical.
Got it. More potent.
It's more close. It's closer to methamphetamine than it is.
Okay, got it.
And both of us were meth guys before that, so we were both fucking angry, dude. And so we jumped him. And, I think the statute of limitations is over this now, but regardless, both of us decided not to press charges at the time, so there was not a, there's nothing that can happen to that one. I don't know who the kid is. The other kid that was involved in it is dead. So, we jumped him, and in the process, not proud of that, by the way, definitely not proud of that, but we did what we did, and I'm man enough to admit it. But, he stabbed me. In the process, there was a lot of time where I had to figure out like what was I doing, like after that, like because there was a lot of it of like, man, why the fuck would that fuck that kid, like, you know, and like, oh fuck the other kid that was involved in it, that because he got led me down that path, and then eventually what eventually got me to get over the everything. Literally, even the drinking, which was a couple years later, was that I had to admit that it was my fault.
Yep.
I deserved every ounce of what that kid did to me. And I would have done the exact same thing.
Right.
I would have done the exact same thing in that situation.
Yeah, it wasn't an overreaction.
It was not an overreaction. It was absolutely deserved. And if that kid were out there and he were to reach out for whatever reason, like I would immediately just want to apologize. Because I'm sure I did some damage to that kid's life.
Yeah, but there's a really good saying. I believe the saying is the only way to truly get over any form of betrayal is to take full responsibility and forgive yourself.
Sure.
And so in moments like that, when you feel slighted, betrayed, taken advantage of, any situation where it feels like someone took a power moment over you, and you go, well, I put myself in the situation, and so it's my bad, and I'm okay that it's my bad. I'll be okay with myself. I can let that go. Then it's like, you don't need that other person's forgiveness. Because, you know, the situation is obviously, it's not like he was fully innocent either. I mean, he sold you fake shit.
Sold us fake shit.
So, you know, you end up in that situation where it escalates on all sides.
Yeah, and that was why I think that was the reason ultimately I was like, I'm not pressing charges, and I'm pretty sure he said the same thing, and I think that was ultimately why I was, because it was just like, there's no innocent party here.
No.
Everybody's guilty. Everybody, if either one presses charges, we're both going to prison.
Mm-hmm.
And like, so I think we just both avoided it. Thank God. I think about that every day. I have a fucking fat wound on my head and my neck and my shoulder because of this, and I think about it every day. But it's also something that as much as it hurt and much as it sucked at the time and as much as it tore apart a bunch of my friends between us, and like, I don't think I would change it, because it made me who I am now. Mm-hmm. And it made me someone that I respect now, because I was able to kind of overcome more. And that's something that I think with addiction in general, and anything in trauma and dealing with hardship in general, is, you know, there are going to be times where, I mean, you'll feel like just giving up and quitting and killing yourself for, you know, that's what it is. You think about committing suicide. You think about what it would be like to kill yourself, and that this could just all end. But when you get actually through the other side of it to the point where you don't actually think about that on a regular basis or even at all, you have so much of this of respect for yourself when you of getting through that, because it's like something where not everybody gets through that, and not everybody experiences it, but also not everybody gets through that. And
I mean, I've obviously seen that firsthand.
Obviously.
Yeah, I mean, which I'll explain as part of my background story. When I was 12, my father committed suicide. Started dealing with, I would say the first time I had any sort of like suicidal ideation was maybe between the ages of 7 and 9.
Yeah.
Was when I first had the thought of like, I wish I wasn't here. I wish I could die already. Right. And then like, what would I have to do to die? I would think about it.
Right.
And then as that progressed, with parents getting divorced, that only got worse. Sure. Then obviously my dad commits suicide. So the root issue too of, and I don't know if you had suicidal ideation prior to getting into hard drug use.
Yeah.
And so when you come into it with those, kind of subconscious thoughts that if you don't truly heal them, they're always lingering in the back. Like the second shit gets bad. Like I've met so many people, so many friends of mine who said when they were younger, I wish I could fucking kill myself, dude. I want to shoot myself. And then life got a little better. They got a new girlfriend, nice slice of ass. They started making money. And they're like, dude, things are awesome. And then shit hit the fan again. They got a breakup and they're like, dude, I'm over it. I want to be gone. Because they never healed it.
Well, right? I think there's a lot to do. There's something to do with that. Whereas if you are happy because of your circumstances, you're not happy.
Right. There's a difference between happiness and joy too.
Yeah.
Right. Like
what
comes from internal versus external situation.
If your happiness in your life comes from the fact that you got a pretty girlfriend, you got a nice ride, you got some money in your pocket, all of those things can go away and just instantly, mm-hmm. dude. So if you have to have, the only thing that you actually have is yourself, which sounds super cheesy, but it's like, that's really true. The only thing that you actually have in this world is yourself.
Agreed.
And and if you don't love yourself, it's no shit that you drink alcohol. It's no shit that you do drugs, because it's like, if you don't love yourself, you're going to abuse yourself just like you would anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, abuse is the wrong word to use there. But when you talk about other people, you don't abuse other people. You just treat other people poorly.
Yeah. And
at least purposely.
Yeah. And I think, too, again, a big component of it is that there's a, when you go down to the nitty gritty of self-idealization and how you're going to move past these negative thoughts you have about yourself, one of the things I constantly see as failure to categorize and just all kind of getting lumped together is liking yourself versus loving yourself.
Oh, yeah.
And there are absolutely times, right now, I would describe as a time in my life where I love myself, I don't like myself.
Sure.
I'm starting to make the right decisions. I've made a lot of bad decisions over the last couple of years. I've spent a lot of money. I haven't taken care of a lot of things. I've lost a lot of relationships in my life because of the distance I've created. And so I'm not very happy with the circumstances I've created.
Sure.
But I understand that the only way past that is to forgive and to move on and go, all right, well, I fucked up. I still care about those people. They're not going away. So am I going to do something about it? Am I going to call my little brother tomorrow and go, hey, dude, I know I missed your call the last two times. I said I wouldn't do that anymore. My bad. And then sit down and have that conversation.
Right.
And that only happens if you have enough love for yourself to respect the people who care about you.
Oh, yeah.
Because otherwise it's like, well, I'm just a piece of shit, you know.
Yeah.
I'm better gone anyway.
That's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Absolutely. And it's super egotistical. And for a long time, I was convinced that was a logical thought, that if I could prove that my value was in the cumulative stance negative, that if I did more damage than good, then it was good for me to be a piece of shit and distance myself from everybody. And as I'm causing them harm, I'm convincing myself it's the right thing because I'm protecting them from the piece of shit that I am.
Sure.
Then I get a little older, a little wiser, and I go, all right, fuck, well, I wouldn't treat anybody else that way. And the biggest thing I ever had for getting past that was I had a mentor that said, do a visualization process, did it while on mushrooms, and it was to go back and imagine sitting with yourself as a child.
We're pro mushroom on this channel.
We are pro mushroom. Not pro mushrooms every day. Don't be doing 7 gram ball trips constantly. You're going to lose your mind.
Do things smart.
It's a medicine. Read up on shamanic shit. Anyhow.
Yes.
But it was to sit down and talk to the version of your younger self that fucked everything up in the first place.
Okay, yeah.
And it was, if you were that kid's father or their big brother, how would you talk to them? And it crushed me.
That crushes
you. Because I was like, I can't yell at this kid. Like, this kid doesn't know anything. This kid hasn't learned to love anything yet, you know? And that broke me apart. And so that was what allowed me to start forming the idea of self-love, was that if I put myself in the external of me talking to myself as two separate people, I would never have that conversation.
Right.
I would never say that to my little cousin. I'd never talk to my little brother that way. I would never say those things ever. And so once I was able to formulate that, it started to help some with the self-talk, of course.
Sure.
I think both of us grew up a little bit old school in certain regards of the...
Yeah.
All right, don't be a fucking pussy.
Don't be
a
fucking pussy.
Which, I still have some issues with being a little over the top at times, but the idea of worthlessness has...
Yes.
Has slowly dissipated over the course of my existence.
That's good. That's good, because that's one of those things that it's like, you know, I don't think there's anybody that doesn't have worth. You have something. Everybody's got something that they're good at. Everybody's got something that they've got that they enjoy doing, and you can bring worth to that, to the world, and best by being yourself, and best by doing the things that you love to do. But and specifically with the idea of suicide, it's a really obviously controversial topic, and people have dealt with it in different ways throughout their whole lives, whether it be through a personal experience with somebody else or whether it be with themselves suffering from the ideation of it. But I mean, it truly is, and this is kind of just reiteration here, but it truly is the only way that I ever got over that idea of wanting to kill myself was by forgiving myself for my past sins.
Mm-hmm.
And for, which if you want to get into religion and all that stuff, the idea of God forgiving yourself for your sins, you have to do it too, dude. You can't just say God did it, so I'm fine. You still might hate yourself for it, but you've got to forgive yourself too. And, you know, the other thing, it was actually coming to a place where I felt like I loved myself and trying to love myself and trying to show myself love. And telling, sometimes you have to say it. Sometimes you just go, I love you, dude. And the self-talk to thing is actually a huge, it makes a huge difference.
Those 3M mirror conversations hit a little different, you know, those conversations about, all right, man, I love you, dude. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
That was a big thing for me too, was apologizing myself verbally.
Mm-hmm.
Walking through the things I had done that led me to my circumstances, because it was allowed me to both take responsibility for it and also move past it. Where as opposed to being like, look what I did, it was like, I'm sorry for it. I'm acknowledging I did it. I mean, I'm acknowledging I ended up in this circumstance, but I don't have to say it as like a, you know, me just being on the recipient end of all the anger and the confrontation, which is very weird. It's, you know, I wish I knew more about psychology so I could delve into it further. But that idea of the identity,
we'll get a psychologist on.
Yeah, we're really at the end of the day, it's just this internal loop of, well, am I the good guy or the bad guy in my own story?
Oh yeah,
and you just constantly flip through, and it, stepping out of it and realizing that it's all just one big circle is where you start moving forward in life, I think.
Right. Yeah, and that like, that. I mean, obviously, getting back to the storyline here, after I got stabbed, I really just went, I spiraled quick. Because mm-hmm. I still hadn't dealt with all the past trauma.
Right.
And I was still, which I'll get to in a later episode of what the first, or really second trauma was. But the idea of spiraling when you don't have the trauma dealt with is, I mean, it makes a whole lot of sense, because you don't have anything to live for. But the only thing that I at the time, the only thing I had to live for was just to get up the next day. Eventually, after a little bit after that happened, I got a dog. Amy's here right now. I got a dog, and that gave me something to live for. That gave me something to get up every morning for and like not just be miserable. But I was still miserable. And like, and eventually it, you know, I was still doing drugs constantly. I was doing a lot of coke. I got into, I eventually, what changed kind of the pattern of thinking and things, I went and did the ketamine-assisted psychotherapy, which is an incredible helpful treatment for severe depression and for severe post-traumatic stress. But it's, you can slip into that world, and we've seen that firsthand pretty recently with someone who also shall remain nameless. And you know, it's a really dangerous world when you're dealing with drugs that are at their nature addictive, especially when you're using them and they're right in front of you, and all you want to do is be in that world. You just think about ketamine specifically. I'm talking about here. You feel like you just want to go into that other dimension, because that other dimension is a lot better than the one you're existing in right now.
Right.
And you know, it can lead you down a pretty dangerous path. And thankfully, I was, you know, I got to a point with K where I was like, okay, I think I'm okay off this. I think I'm doing okay. I don't need to keep using this. And then, you know, you had to dip back into it. And now I'm at a point where I don't use it at all.
Well, I think part of that too is just the dissociation factor that so much now with the buzzwords of psychology getting thrown around. And not that I'm not guilty of it at times, but you know, we put labels on things and then take this entire category of behavior where almost exclusively I see dissociation or disassociative behaviors as being an inherently negative trait.
Right.
They're like, oh, you're disassociating right now.
Right.
It's like, yeah, I probably am. It's one of the first things you learn to do as a child.
Yes.
You find a way to kind of distract yourself and go off to some other place.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if that's taking over your life, of course that's not good.
Right.
But just like earlier, like I was talking about, you know, sometimes you got to break the leg. It's like you also have to stop walking on it when you're healing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so just when you're going through trauma, and I was thinking about it when you talked about going back to California and dealing with the same problems all over again. I had the same fucking issues where I would think I was doing better, and I go home and spend a little time with family, and I'm like back to this psychosis of like, fuck, yeah. I'm on edge all the time, and I'm constantly in fight or flight. I always want to be somewhere else. I always want to be fucked up. And it was just because I couldn't find a way to dissociate healthily, and so it became a negative behavior. But as I found other more stable points of my life, there are of course times where I deal with shit, and then I go, all right, I can't deal with this anymore right now. I'm going to find another way to kind of distract myself because this hurts a lot.
Right.
Whether it's through grieving, through something, like if you lose somebody you love.
So
you can't think about that all the time. You can't ruminate constantly. You'll go fucking insane.
Yes.
You've got to have breaks and find some part in your mind, your little happy place, and be able to just go off. But, you know, it's having that balance of, like you said, acknowledging, all right, this is becoming too good for me, where I'm not paying any more attention here, and all I'm focused on is getting to that other side. There is a balance of being able to step back and forth in between those areas to make sure that you're still being productive in both worlds, you know?
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's where a lot of people struggle. And that's where a lot of people, like, you see in getting into a recovery side of things, you see a lot of people when they get into recovery, they just dive into something. It's different for everybody. Some people dive right into a relationship, which is called 13th stepping. And some people do that. And some people dive right into a career, like a job or something, and they just fully become a workaholic. Some people, you know, dive into the AA stuff. Some people dive into their full recovery thing.
Religion,
that's another thing. I saw a meme today that said, like, the worst part about being a drug addict is becoming religious. If you just replace drugs with something else, I mean, yeah, it can be harm reduction, which is, you know, that is a good thing. To just being, doing whatever you can to stay on top of your shit and on top of your life and not in the fucking gutter. Because if you can't stay out of the gutter without smoking a little bit of weed, smoke a little bit of weed, dude. Maybe you'll quit doing that in a little bit. But right now, if you just need to get a little bit of weed to get you over the hump, fucking smoke a little weed, dude.
Right.
But don't smoke a little meth. Don't do something that's gonna, you know, that could severely harm you.
No, the big thing is acknowledging too that it is a replacement.
Yeah, and also you can't just say like, well, it's not. You have to. Yeah, what you just said. You have to acknowledge that it's a replacement. You have to acknowledge what you're doing is maybe not perfect. but this is better than what I was doing. And, you know, just get yourself over the hump. Get yourself to the next day, and then maybe you can think about quitting weed tomorrow. You know, it's just don't drink today. Don't do your, you know, thing that's going to harm you today.
And then move forward. And then, I mean, that's like, I'm fat as shit right now. Yeah. You know, go from eating like, you know, a pound of ice cream every day to maybe a small tub of ice cream every day.
Small tub, there you go.
It's, should you be eating ice cream on the daily? No. I shouldn't be doing that.
No.
But
that's also
it's better than what I was doing before. Addiction. And it's a step in the right direction. Yeah, of course, you know. It's another, again, one of those like kind of coping mechanisms and stress responses of like, all right, here I go.
That's another thing you see. You see some people out getting out of rehab and they get really fat. Uh-huh. It's because they just like, they need to replace.
A lot with ex-smokers. Yeah.
And also, because nicotine's an appetite suppressant.
Right. And you get like the tongue thing too. Yeah, so you start getting flavor back.
Yeah.
And on top of that, now you want that oral fixation.
Yes.
No longer fucking cigarettes and Marlboros. Now it's French fries from McDonald's.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, boy.
Yeah. And, you see some people get fat after rehab because they just, they replace alcohol or with food. And also, alcohol is a sugar.
Mm-hmm.
The best way to get rid of alcohol cravings, by the way, a little malfunction junction tip for you here. If you're dealing with alcohol cravings and you want to get rid of that shit, eat a fucking candy bar. And if you're me, go for some cherry sours. Those are my favorite for that. And
for the love of God, don't mix the two. You're gonna feel like shit tomorrow.
Terrible. Just miserable. Miserable. So what steps did you take to get yourself out of these places, these low points in your life?
So, of course, I want to reiterate that I'm not fully past all of my addictive behaviors by any means. The biggest things for me were what we talked about earlier in terms of the kind of self-love and a lot of the re-walking through old trauma. I had tried to do it when I was younger, and like I said, it kind of collapsed me. I went to therapy, reopened some stuff I wasn't ready to. And so as I've gotten older, I've been able to deal with those in smaller and smaller tidbits. And journaling was a really big part of it. I can never emphasize enough how important I think meditation and prayer are in your life. I think having set time for just letting thoughts roll. Meditation does not have to be an absence of thought. It's just at the bare minimum, try and make it an absence of controlling thought and just letting things flow, become the observer. Eckhart Tolle, read that a little bit, if I'm pronouncing that right. But Power Now talks about this idea of being an observer to your thoughts, letting them come and go, and just witnessing them, because you're hearing them, you're responding to them, right? So that was big for me, was having those times for meditation. And prayer, just, again, even as a concept, it doesn't have to be this, here's my exact God and deity and thing I'm praying to. But finding something where you worship and acknowledge your insignificance. A daily part of my mantra now, this is something I've been doing for probably the last 4 or 5 months. One of the things I say to myself almost every day is, thank God I'm a human. Thank God.
That's good.
Thank God I don't have to worry about controlling people. Thank God I'm not responsible for the things that go wrong across the world. Thank God that I don't have the moral and, you know, all the weight on my shoulders and this duty to make things good at all times, because those tendencies are what led me constantly throughout my life to feel pressured, stress out, and then go back to addiction.
Right.
Was that I felt like I had to, you know, my dad's not here. I got to step up for my brother and sister. Oh shit, I'm not doing a good enough job. Fuck, I need to get out of here. That over and over again. So having that, like, hey dude, I'm an ant in an elephant's world. It's all right. I'm cool with that. Thank the Lord. You know, those things for me, that, again, just changing perspective, ideology shifts, for me, a lot of it came from mushroom use, from having a lot of conversations with friends of mine, but it doesn't have to. You know, you can find those things in sobriety. It may take longer. It may be easier for you. Everybody's different.
Right.
But for me, it was, again, just changing my perspective on what my responsibility is and what the onus of duty for changing constantly is in my life. It's not the responsibility I thought I needed to have when I was 19 and 20, that if I'm not perfect tomorrow, then I'm failing.
Right.
It's no longer the goal for me.
So
that's allowed me to make smaller steps. I still struggle with that. I tend to be more of an all or nothing person, but all of those things accumulate to the biggest and most important piece of advice for which I've been being told since I was 6 years old, which is, you don't have to do it all today. is yeah. that you can take a step.
That's great advice.
You can take a step in the right direction. You can start making a step or advancement yeah. in these, you know, whether it's looking for a rehab center, looking for advice, talking to a therapist. Just, my mom used to tell me all the time, just set the fucking appointment, Jay.
Right.
That's it. That's all you got to do. Just set the fucking appointment and then we'll deal with it when it comes. And so getting to a point where I could do that is what has allowed me to, at the bare minimum, if not anything else, allowed me to feel more optimistic about moving forward in life. Where before it felt like this giant wall that I just didn't have the strength to climb. Right. Now it's a stair. Now it's a staircase, and I can
yeah,
take one step.
Take
at a time.
One step at a time there, mm-hmm. and that's, you know, that's one of the most important things to realize. There is that piece of advice that you said is just, you know, the same thing as saying Rome wasn't built in a day. You know?
Right.
It's it wasn't. It was, you know, nothing worthwhile was built in a day. Everything worthwhile takes time. Mm-hmm. And I think getting sober, or at the very least getting healthy for yourself, is extremely worthwhile. And it can be very rewarding. It can be very painful, too. There's a lot of stuff that, you know, you'll go through getting sober that, you know, it sucks. It's there's a lot of stuff that goes on, and whether you go to a rehab center and go through it, it sucks, or whether it's right after you get out. Or whether it's you never win at all and you're just getting clean yourself. Like, there's stuff that can truly bite about this stuff. But, you know, it also, there's a lot of ways, coping mechanisms that you can do to replace the substance,
mm-hmm.
At least the substance use. And were there any, like, specific books or anything like that that helped you along the way?
I've actually been thinking of one.
Podcasts or programs, anyway?
There's a few I'd recommend. Oh, God, I'm going to forget it now. It's, I think, The Journey of the Peaceful Warrior. There's a second one that I started reading a few months ago. I haven't picked back up since. Another one is How to Think Like a Monk by Jay Shetty. It talks a lot about these ideas of self-gratification, about, like, mental thought patterns and the loops we drive ourselves on. And then a quote that I've been thinking of was this book. I think it's called The Fox, the Boy, the Fox, and the Horse.
Okay.
And I know I'm going to get that wrong, but there's a quote in it where the horse says to the boy, can you walk through the woods? And he says, I can't see the other side. And he said, can you see enough in front of you to take a step? And he says, yes. And he says, then just take that one. And so I still, you know, as with almost everything in my life, I've gotten about halfway through them all.
Oh, yeah.
And then put them down. But
yeah.
Those were all enough for me to feel like I could take action. So those three for sure recommend. The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, that's what it was.
Okay.
And when it comes to podcasts, there's none that I've been super selective on. For me, I struggled a lot with health anxiety, so my brother constantly sends me little clips of those.
Sure.
But to me, the biggest thing that I learned from, with caution and with understanding the tendency for, like, trauma bonds and commiseration, it's being around other people who've been through the same shit.
Oh, yeah.
And
or at the very least,
I don't know how much you want to discuss the communities that we hang out at, in terms of, yeah, the Kava and Kratom community. And not that it's without its own issues, but for me, being in those circles and being around people who understand that, as opposed to a lot of my family members who, God love them, but didn't have the same experience. So it kind of made me feel like a black sheep. And then shut down, right?
Sure.
Where absolutely. They're like, "What? Why do you keep doing that? And maybe that's why you're depressed, because you have drug issues." And it's like, well, no. Like, I'm telling you, you got it backwards. Like, I've got these issues, and that's what's leading me to cope in a really unhealthy way.
Right.
But I don't know how to deal with that. And so being around people who I can talk about that with, you being one of them,
right,
has been probably the most productive, more than any book, podcast, or anything I could ever recommend. It's find a community.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, the Kava and Kratom community is definitely it's a controversial subject within addiction spaces, but
uh-huh.
It's been a lifesaver, because it's something that somewhere where you can go to be and talk to people and just be around someone at any time of the day. And it's, you know, the substances are kind of come secondary there. Whereas yep. I felt like at a bar, you can like a real bar, you're there for the substance. You're not there for the talk. You're there for the substance. And I mean, at least that's how it felt. And it doesn't feel that way with Kava and Kratom. It feels like you're there for the hang. And it's
and it feels like the definition of the Common Creative Community is to both create a community and a support team for those in recovery and harm reduction to the fullest extent.
Absolutely.
It's to find replacements where, again, you're people who drink and you want to go to a bar and space out. You don't want to sit at home, deal with your shit. Maybe you got family issues. You got shit you just can't face. And you're like, I need to get out of the house. And you still get that, you know, I can go to the bar, I can go play pool. I'm not gonna leave and crash in a ditch. Wake up 12 hours you know, or sleep through 3 days anymore, be throwing up for 7 hours. And so, like, not having that, still having all the positive aspects of those communities, and, like, at least ours, which I'll give a shout out to.
That would be That's Kava over here in Inglewood, Colorado.
Yep. You know, they have made such an effort to create new events and activities. And we have the Dharma Recovery now that meets once a week. And all they do is talk about their journeys with spirituality and addiction.
Right.
But they got the philosophy group now. They have 10 different other small tournaments and activities and games and shit we do that include people from all these walks of life. Which, like I said, it's created a community that, as much as I love the information I've gathered from therapy, from books, from podcasting, whatever it may be, nothing has mattered more. Nothing has mattered more than having people in my life that understood me. Because that was the root of my early drug problem, I think, and over everything else was just that I couldn't understand me, people couldn't understand me, and it drove me mad. And then I got older and found people who could, and it gives a sense of, like, peace.
Yeah, and I'm sure
you don't have to change for people.
No, never change for anybody. Just be yourself, and there will be people that you connect with. There's so many people on this planet. You'll connect with a lot of people, and I felt the same way. I'm sure there's people that'll listen to this that feel the same way, of that they just didn't fit in wherever they were going in, you know, whether it's in high school or whether it's even in college for some people. Like, they just felt like they didn't fit in, and you know, there's a place for everybody, and you got to find that place for you, because otherwise you're going to end up in that downward spiral of
self-isolation.
Yeah. And you know, and that's, you know, and as much as some people really do, oh, I'm the lone wolf or whatever, it's like, no, everybody loves to be fucking protect. Like, everybody loves to have people around them.
Right.
And whether it's...
Even the lone wolf wants to be respected as well. Even though, tell everyone they're a fucking lone wolf.
Right, exactly.
I'm Sigma, dude. It's like, nobody gives a shit. You wouldn't have to tell me if you were, you know? Yeah. Like, yeah. If that was a real thing, you wouldn't be posting about it on Instagram, you dumbass.
Right, for real. But yeah, I think we'll get getting pretty close to getting out of here. I think we'll kind of end on and we'll probably go more into stuff like this on later episodes. Like I said, we're gonna be doing this once a week, and but one of the main things, how did your self-image change after you got sober, or at least, you know, healthy? Or
I'm gonna kind of break into two. One is the self-image is an act where how the subconscious is affecting, and most of that changed with self-love and seeing myself as someone who is deserving of a second chance,
right,
constantly, which is that is something I try to extend to every person in my life, mm-hmm. and to every idea of the people around, is that I'm not capable of judging because I haven't walked in those shoes yet.
Sure.
And extending that to myself has changed a lot about my subconscious treatment, where now I don't want to do things that are inherently harmful in my life anymore. So that kind of subconscious self-identity has just become more accepting, I think, is the key word there. And then the other part of, like, active self-image, of how I see myself as an individual, I've stopped with a lot of the narcissistic things that I kept up when I was in these cycles of addiction, which is, well, I suck right now and I'm the worst person in the world, but I'm also better at all these things, and I can be good. You just wait. Like,
right,
if I wasn't doing this, dude, I'd be better than that. Like, don't.
Yeah.
And so getting, like, rid of that.
Narcissistic.
And
just, yeah.
Right. Definitely. And accepting that I fall into the middle ground on all things, as everyone does, that no matter how far on one end of the spectrum you are, you're still on it. Right.
Right.
And so for me, the act of self-identity has just been seeing myself as a person who is flawed, capable of change, you know, inherently unique and valued, and so on and so forth, and not trying to assess, like, good, bad, positive, negative, to all these qualities of who I am as an individual, but instead to see myself as something that is ever changing and ever evolving. You know, not trying to make myself feel good about things has made me feel a lot less shitty when I don't do well.
Absolutely. And that's what you, I liked what you said there about, you know, we're always changing. We're throughout our whole lives. We're never, the change is the only constant. And it's, you know, I don't know what quote that's from, but change is the only constant. The only thing that you can guarantee is going to happen is that things are going to change. And, you know, that's tough for some people to get, because a lot of people aren't comfortable with change. But it's something that if you're not comfortable with change, you should probably fix that, because I don't know how.
Well, so much of it is trauma too, right? Yeah. It's like you close off to this entire side of who you are.
Oh, absolutely.
I think you kind of touched on that earlier with the idea of psychedelics, which is that you have this shit and you're like, oh dude, it's insane and it's terrifying and it's also awesome and awe-inspiring in a lot of ways. But if you don't touch it and you don't deal with it and you don't delve into it ever, then you have to stay rigid. And you become this person where all you are is your identities and traits, and I'm this thing and I'm that thing and I'm capable of this. And it's like, if I say, who are you? And the only, well, I'm Jay and I'm good at football. And I'm good. It's like, right, yeah. If that becomes your self-identity because you won't delve into the darker parts, then when those things don't work out, you collapse as a person.
Absolutely.
That was kind of wrestling for me too. I mean, like, yeah, you talked about where that became my life. And I was like, if I'm nothing else, I'm good at this.
Right.
And then I got hurt as a senior and I didn't wrestle in college. And I was like, oh, fuck, what am I now? You know?
Yeah.
And it broke me apart.
Yeah, absolutely. So
just allowing the identity to be fluid in the first place is, in my opinion, the most impactful for giving yourself room to grow. Where it's like, you don't have to be any one particular thing, like attaching all the adjectives and characteristics and traits. It's not really something I think about as much anymore. Right. Hardly ever.
Yeah. And that's good. That's great, man. It's good to see you going, getting on to some stuff too. Cause like you had mentioned, we'd been talking about some stuff for a long time about, improving both of our lives in general, and both of us have been taking those steps lately, so we're here. We'll get out of here. It's been about an hour now, hour 13, so we're gonna get out of here, but I guess why don't we leave on a potential message of hope for someone who's potentially struggling.
You want to lead off, or you want me?
I can lead off. I've got, you know, if there's anything that I can say that's hopeful, is that it's something that's obviously very straightforward and simple, is that it does get better, dude. That doesn't seem like something that you're gonna, that seems like something so simple to say and something so like, oh yeah, no shit. But like, people, if you're really struggling right now, you might not feel like it's ever gonna get better. It does get better. It might be not better tomorrow, it might not be better the next day, but it keep going, keep taking that next step and that next step forward, do the next right thing, and things will get better.
And to add on to that, and to try and keep that kind of positive flow, I had a great quote one time from a friend of mine who said, expectations breed entanglements, entanglements breed disappointment. And in talking about that, what it got me to do was to drop the expectation of, it has to get better tomorrow. Is that there is no timeline on your journey. That this idea of, you know, if you're struggling with addiction, that if you're not clean tomorrow, you're not worthy of love. You got to get rid of that. And if you just allow yourself a little bit of room to breathe and you treat yourself as you would a child and just give yourself a little bit of time to grow into your shoes, I promise things get easier. Because that burden of constantly expecting that something's going to change or needs to change in order for good things to happen will slowly dissipate. And all of a sudden, you'll find that there's good things all around you. They exist right now. There's constantly good, joyous things in the world. And when you go out tomorrow, if you can stop being so focused and fixated on not being good enough yet, then you can start to see that every kid that laughs on the side of the road, every family in the car that's dancing to their music, everything is a reason to smile. And it's all around you. You're never too far from it. So smile a little bit. Try and take a breath. Take a little bit of space. Sit down. Spend some time with your thoughts. And yeah, you'll find exactly what you're looking for.
Well, right on. That was great. I like that a lot. Well, all right, everybody. We're going to get out of here. Thank you for listening to our first episode of Malfunction Junction.
Hell yeah. Thank you very much.
Please, if you have any questions, want to share your stories, anything like that, please reach out to us. We have an Instagram now. It is at Malfunction Junction Pod. I think that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, we can also, you can also email us. It is, I guess I don't have an actual email address for it yet, but it's, you can email me, aredwardsfilm@gmail.com. I'll post that in the description as well. Jay, anything, any last things before we get out of here?
No, thank you guys very much. Try and keep an open mindset. And if you feel like you're struggling, you feel like you're going to jump off a cliff, at least wait till the next episode. Maybe we got something for you.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Thank you, everybody. Have a great rest of your night.